With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk a bit about the way in which Karl Marx was interpreted during the 1870s and 1880s, and after his death in 1883, and how this interpretation has really shaped the view that his supporters and detractors have had of him posthumously. The book that I'm reading from is a fantastic biography of Marx, Karl Marx, Greatness and Illusion by Gareth Stedman Jones, one of the best things that has been written about him. And the point that Stedman Jones makes at the beginning of the book is that it was mainly the German Social Democratic Party that became the custodians of Marx's ideas from the 1870s onwards. Marx first came to public attention as a thinker in 1871, when he defended the Paris Commune with its resulting bloodshed and chaos, and spoke up for the International Working Men's Association, which had come out in defence of the Paris workers. Within the world of socialist thought, he had become the foremost intellectual in 1867 with the publication of Das Kapital, which was first published in German and then Russian, French, Italian and English. And this made him a controversial figure, not simply outside the international socialist movement, but more importantly within it. He had his die-hard loyalists and adherents, and he had critics too. And because of the nature of the international socialist movement that was perhaps more parochial than we think of now, that had its German, French, English, American and Russian variants who variously tried to coordinate with one another to limited degrees of success. And because of the sectarian nature of socialist parties in the 19th century, and often their secretive nature because of state repression and because of their commitment, that some of their these organisations' commitment to revolution and some to progressive democratic change, there was a great deal of insularity within the movement, and certain parties were hermetically sealed, and it was normally only the predations of people at the Tsarist secret police that were able to access them. The brilliant book, The World That Never Was, by Adam Butterworth, is a testament to the complexities and the secrecies of revolutionary politics in the era. He focuses more on the anarchist movement. Obviously, this has profound overlaps with the socialist movement. It was anarchism that Marx rejected, and Marx is successful in supplanting the likes of Bakunin as the chief revolutionary ideologue of the age. One of the key distinctions that comes about when Marx writes Das Kapital, as was put forward by Friedrich Engels, was that Marxism made socialism no longer a utopian dream, and instead what the socialist movements of Europe claimed to be a science. Essentially a science of economics, but also a science of history, had been developed. They had simple and immutable rules. All history is the history of class struggle. The capitalist societies have inherent contradictions, which leads to their downfall, and that there are such forces as dialectics and materialism, which inevitably lead to revolutions. The events such as the Russian Revolution and the subsequent attempts at revolution in Germany and Hungary and other parts of Europe in the immediate aftermath of the First World War claimed to be vindications of Marx's theory. However, the revisionist historians would suggest that the Russian Revolution was less the actions of masses of angry workers and more the inability of a state, both Tsarist and then Republican, to continue functioning. And it was events such as the Russian Revolution that helped to finally cement Marx's position as some kind of secular 20th century prophet, or 19th century prophet, whose time had come in the 20th century, shall we say. He was venerated for the creation of, as I mentioned, dialectical materialism, and in communist countries, obviously, throughout the 20th century, he has been on banners and statues and has been venerated in public squares and in mass celebrations, and his works have sold at certain points in greater quantities than the Bible itself. And that really tells you more about the nature of 20th century authoritarian socialist regimes than it does about Marx himself. However, most of the mythology surrounding Marx was not created by Lenin or Stalin. In fact, it was in full swing by the time of Marx's death in 1883. And in the decades following it, it developed yet further. The invention of Marxism was in large part the creation of Engels in his books and pamphlets that were published before and after Marx's death. The first being the Anti-Düring, which was published in 1878. The Anti-Düring was a response to the socialist intellectual Eugen Düring, who had created a synthesis of Marxism that was designed to replace it and criticise Das Kapital. The Anti-Düring contained ideas which have been mistaken for Marxist critique, such as the idea that the state itself isn't overthrown, it is simply following the capture of power by the workers, will be allowed to wither away. This was one of the great hopes that Russian revolutionaries such as Nikolai Bukharin and, of course, Trotsky had, but Lenin by 1918 had fully abandoned when he wrote State and Revolution. Intellectuals in the Social Democratic Party in Germany, such as August Bebel and Karl Kautsky, were keen to present Marx as this historical prophet and this scientist of history. And this is significant because obviously up till 1914. The Social Democratic Party is the largest socialist party in the world and had the ability to influence the development of other socialist parties and was one of the kind of the great arbiters in the 19th century as to what socialism actually was. Obviously, socialism is an immensely sectarian and fissile ideology with innumerable different people and groups interpreting it in a variety of different ways. It was bound to emerge. And the figure of Marx, before and after his death, is suborned to the position of the importance of the party, the authority of the party. And it was opportune to protect Marx's reputation, to advance him as a revolutionary prophet, a scientist of history, in order to lend legitimacy to whatever it was that the party had to say. You know, in the way that I suppose religions work, you have the backing of an infallible figure who has prophetic visions of how history has developed, but based in kind of the secular language of science, that this is a powerful stuff that backs up the and underpins the authority of the party. And it's not just socialist parties that have done this. If you think about how any party of the political right in the second half of the 20th century has made cases for free markets and based their political, economic and social ideas upon that, well, they've had the supposed science of free market economists to back them up and to lend credence and an air of kind of white-coated technocratic science to the policies that they come up with periodically and predictably disastrous results. Of course, in this highly contested Europe, this ideologically contested Europe in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, the agenda, the Marxist programme offers a viable alternative to the forces of nationalism, conservatism or anarchism, and particularly in the case of nationalism in the years prior to the First World War, and then immediately after, you have the development of fascist thinking emerging out of that, this strange concoction of radical ideologies. As guardians of Marx's legacy, the Social Democrats made sure in Germany that they controlled Marx and Engels' papers. Marx and Engels' papers, a bit like the Dead Sea Scrolls, if read in their entirety, often present a slightly different picture of the infallible seer of history and show Marx as an individual with feet of clay like the rest of us.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
prone to misjudgments, errors, misunderstandings, and his own private prejudices as well. Because if Marx wasn't under the scrutiny of the Wilhelmine government in Germany particularly, then certainly the Social Democratic Party was, and there were repeated attempts by Bismarck to persecute the socialist movement in Germany. And then following the fall of Bismarck, the Kaiser has very faltering attempts to position himself as this populist figure, populist kind of paternalist figure, who would do right by the working man, but who ultimately was far too inconsistent and misguided to do anything productive on behalf of the working classes. So finding any excuse to attack the democratic left and to point out Marx's shortcomings was an immense gift for the Wilhelmine government, and one which obviously it wasn't in the interests of the social democratic movement to allow. So again, in the protection of Marx's legacy, the inflation of Marx from a revolutionary thinker to a revolutionary prophet and an infallible scientist of history is the kind of the resultant process. The claims made about his thought, his legitimacy, were made, and any shortcomings that Marx had were glossed over. And the reality is that Marx was far from being the only revolutionary thinker of the 19th century. Fourier, Proudhon, and other figures of the left who had emanated from France in the 1830s were just as significant, if not slightly more so, and Marx drew heavily on their work. And this is something that Marx himself would have been happy to acknowledge. And the most important part of his works, as far as the Social Democrats were concerned, was the Marxist theory of collapse, or the Zusammenbruch theory, as it is in German. This was published in Volume 3 of Das Kapital, which was published 11 years after Marx's death. And there are some fascinating similarities between the theory of collapse and ideas that are currently being articulated in contemporary discourse, which could be described as post-capitalist. You read Paul Mason's book Post-Capitalism on this one. And this said that capitalism would not come to an end as a result of a workers' revolt, but it would come to an end as a result of its own dissolution. It would reach a point of terminal breakdown, ultimately, when there were no further markets to exploit. What Marx predicted at the time, along with Rosa Luxemburg and Lenin and the English economist J.A. Hobson, was that you'd get to a point where everything had been colonised, where there were no further resources for capitalists to lay their hands on, to take to their factories and turn into products. And at that point, when all the resources had been used up or had been captured, or when all the markets had been satiated, you know, all the stuff that needed to be made for people to consume had been made, then capitalism would start to fall apart. Marx perhaps didn't recognise on the kind of the plastic nature of capitalism, its ability to evolve, to find and even invent new markets. Perhaps one of the things that he was unaware of that would perhaps justify his theory would be the ability of human beings to create things like the internet and the distribution of free or largely free information, such as code like Linux, on which everything is built on, and that kind of thing. Anyway, read Post-Capitalism, it's a really good book. So collapse would come not as a result of the workers' revolution, but as a result of the capitalism's dissolution of itself. This was eventually becomes a very contentious idea under Stalin, and there are numerous economists, particularly the economist Kondratiev, who are lined up and shot when they present information or evidence that this is sort of actually starting to occur. Because Stalinist orthodoxy was still that a workers' revolution worldwide would be the way in which capitalism would be swept away, and the idea that capitalism would undo itself started to make Stalinists pretty redundant. Not something that an idea that Stalinists ideally like to entertain. Volume 3 came under attack from members of the Social Democratic Party, particularly Edward Bernstein. And August Bebel was forced into a position of defending Marx and becoming alarmed at what the criticisms of Marx portended for the Social Democrat Party. Bernstein was eventually labelled as a heretic at party congresses, and his views were dismissed as revisionism. And so Marxism became, what we understand of as Marxism, is really the orthodox Marxism of the Social Democrat Party among one, and obviously the orthodoxies that are obviously grafted onto it later on following the Russian Revolution by Lenin and later Stalin. And the varieties of Marxism, I suppose, could be seen in the same way as the varieties of Christianity, the profusion of early Christian doctrines in the ancient world that emerged before and after the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Marxism, therefore, is a selective reading of the works of Marx, and an uncritical one at that, perhaps not what Marx had intended. The personal character of Marx was also carefully managed. Again, Karl Kautsky made sure that letters between Marx and Engels were carefully curated. Marx himself is incredibly complicated character with all manner of different views and persuasions, quite a colourful private life, and not the kind of character that a political party wanted to be revealed to the public in warts and all. Which is a shame, because the figure who is finally presented, the rather austere, authoritarian, slightly intimidating figure who stares out from socialist banners and plinths across the world, was quite different from the man himself. Again, a quite complicated individual, beset by financial problems and personal tragedy, whose infidelities and his sense of humour shaped the kind of character that he was. One of the reasons why the Social Democrats became the trustees of his letters and only selectively released them for public consumption is that he appears to have not liked many of their leaders and had immense contempt for Karl Kautsky particularly, and his letters are full of insulting references to the Social Democrat Party. So the Marx of political discourse that we know is a fundamentally different character to the Marx of the 19th century, who has become less and less well known. As Stedman Jones puts it, the figure that had emerged was a forbidding bearded patriarch and lawgiver, a thinker of merciless consistency with a commanding vision for the future. This was Marx as the 20th century was, quite wrongly, to see him. It was a picture brilliantly enunciated by Isaiah Berlin, writing in 1939. Marx's faith in his own synoptic vision was of that boundless, absolute kind which puts an end to all questions and dissolves all difficulties. His intellectual system was a closed one. Everything that entered was made to conform to a pre-established pattern, but it was grounded in observation and experience. And of course Isaiah Berlin would have said these sorts of things in the midst of the tumult, the ideological tumult of the 20th century, because this austere Marx that had been created by the Social Democrat Party particularly, but obviously later by Stalin, by Lenin and Stalin, was one whose works apparently were borne out in the physical experience of Stalinism, the foreboding face on posters and flags and on plinths and on statues was replicated by a foreboding manifestation of his ideology. Except, of course, there is very little in Marx's writing that explains Stalin, and also there is very little in the reality of Marx the individual that would have predicted Stalin. So, as it suggests, the 20th century Marx is very different from the 19th century version. Anyway, I hope you found this useful and enjoyable, and I'll be bringing you some more podcasts throughout the Christmas period. Do have a nice holiday, and I'll catch you all in January, ready to go again for a year of interesting podcasts in 2018. Thanks, all the best, bye-bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.